Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. There are young conservatives who are not only seeing themselves as engaged citizens, our guest this hour writes, but as guardians of an ancient intellectual tradition. And there are groups in the country that are courses in the political theory, conservative political theory. Very interestingly set up, they are small groups of people who are looking very carefully and quite studiously at a number of conservative thinkers who were in this country, not in this country, but all over the world many years ago. They're looking at Aristotle, James Madison, Leo Strauss, and many others. Perhaps some of the students feeling that they don't get a complete education in conservative political thought in colleges or universities all over the country. And our guest wrote an interesting piece about this. Can I go to Great Books Camp? She is here this hour to talk about why they are springing up in the country and what's being discussed and whether or not we have lost this tradition of very serious intellectual study, be it conservative thought and how conservatism is informed by people who thought many, many centuries ago. Why aren't there very many liberal organizations like this or study groups? Or maybe there are some of them. We'll talk about that. And whether or not we as students in this country or people of any age are taking this kind of, we were talking about it some last hour, getting information from the past to make us better understand what's happening in the present. Our guest is Molly Worthen. She's the author most recently of Apostles of Reason, The Crisis of Authority in American Evangelicalism. She's an assistant professor of history at the University of North Carolina and a contributing opinion writer to the New York Times, which is where the piece Can I Go to Great Books Camp appeared. We thank you very much, Professor Worthen, for being with us. Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it should be really interesting. So these are study groups. They're really interesting, though. They're quite structured. Some of them are long, some of them are short. But it would appear that they're growing, small as they may be, they're growing in numbers.
I think that's right. I think this is still a relatively small phenomenon. It's not a mass movement. The first of these programs started to sprout up at conservative and libertarian think tanks in the 1970s, as far as I can determine. And they take different forms. The Hertog Foundation, which is a kind of more secular sort of Jewish approach to the world of ideas, hosts a very popular one. The Cato Foundation, which is the Cato Institute, which is a more classically libertarian organization, has a different approach. There's another foundation called the John Jay Fellows Program, which takes a more explicitly Christian approach. But the general idea is to bring together a self-selected group of precocious students, either active college students or those just out of college, to, in a quite intense environment, engage with texts of what these groups determine to be the kind of conservative canon, interspersed with lectures and conversations with academics and policy experts.
And do you have to pay to go to these or not?
In almost all cases, as far as I could determine in my research, these programs are funded. So young people who are interested send in an application, usually involves writing a personal statement, some demonstration of their academic record in university, and almost all of them pay the accepted student's way. Some also add on a stipend on top of this. Many of them are residential, so they're covering the student's cost of living for, you know, ranging from just a few days to, in the case of the John Jay Fellows Program, several months.
Mm. And I love the description of one of them. I'm not sure where it was, where students actually get up in the morning and wear robes to go to their discussion groups. You're getting dressed for your thinking, right?
Right. That has been the practice at the John Jay Fellows Program for, I think, about nearly 10 years now, although they've just gotten a new director who has decided to do away with that particular requirement. And I was very sorry to hear that. And in fact, my article mentioned that this particular feature of that program is no longer required. And I got a couple of emails from alumni of that program really lamenting the fact that black academic gowns were no longer de rigueur, because they really appreciated that element of the experience that really, I think, forced students to say, okay, I am stepping out of my everyday iPhone-bound life, and I am really a scholar at this moment.
Right. That's why I'm here, for heaven's sake, to become a scholar. Are these young people who ultimately want to go into politics, would you say?
A lot of them do have some kind of political vocation in mind, not necessarily electoral politics. Some of them are interested in journalism, but conservative journalism. Others headed into the think tank world after doing these programs. Others are engaging in education reform in different ways. So they take all sorts of different paths. A number of them go on to academe and pursue graduate degrees of various kinds. Even though there is this narrative that propels these programs of conservative alienation from the academy, you know, so much of what sustains these programs is the idea that they are offering something that students can't get at the average university.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're at a university. Is that true, that there's really a defect in mainstream higher ed when it comes to studying conservative thought?
Well, I think there is a defect, but I wouldn't say that it is particularly aimed at the alienation of conservatives. I would say that today's university is very careerist and pragmatic in its aims. Students are encouraged not just by the university curriculum, but by other pressures, the economy, their parents, their own very legitimate concerns about their future, to pursue courses that ignore the history of ideas entirely. And when they do have any opportunity to read classic texts, either from ancient times or some of the great political thinkers of our own era, often it's a kind of spotty, you know, incomplete treatment. So I would say liberal students are not getting a great history of the liberal intellectual tradition either. And so in that sense, yeah, I think that these programs are providing a valuable kind of intellectual engagement that is not happening enough in most universities.
Yeah, it's probably not happening enough in our society. The intellectual tradition doesn't seem to be highly prized.
No, but perhaps it never really has been. You know, it's kind of inherently an elite project, and it's very hard to make it accessible and interesting to lots and lots of people. And I'm not sure that these programs are aiming at that. You know, they're aiming at providing this kind of education for people who can do it, who will hopefully then become conduits for these ideas and for a kind of debate about some of these texts in broader society.
Mm-hmm. So they're not only reading a text, there are also people, policymakers, I would imagine, professors occasionally, people from the business world who come to visit and talk to the students.
That's right. Yes, in the case of the Hertog Political Studies program, that program recruits academics to come in and lead seminar discussion with students. And not all of those academics, I should say, are dyed-in-the-wool conservatives. They do recruit some who are a little bit outside that part of the ideological spectrum, to their great credit, I think. And then often in the afternoon or evening, their students will sit for a lecture from, you know, some person with some sort of expertise in the way things really work in Washington. Or in the case of the John Jay Fellows, they will host a tea or a dinner every week to which some business entrepreneur or policy expert or politician will come and socialize with the students in a less formal setting. I mean, the idea is not simply to provide them with this crash course in the history of ideas. It's also to socialize them, to, I think, encourage them to conduct themselves as grown-ups who can talk about these ideas not just like students who are eager for their teacher's approval, but as people who have professional lives, who are trying to make these ideas work in the real world.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot that goes to, and you make mention of this in your article, that there's an enormous impact if you're just taking students seriously.
That's right. As a university professor myself, I'm often frustrated by what I called in the article the high schoolization of university, the way in which nowadays professors have to spend so much time taking attendance, making sure students even show up, or making sure they're not playing on their phones for our whole duration of our lecture, and, you know, dealing with all sorts of things that really get in the way of actually grappling with ideas. And these programs make a point of treating the students who enroll in them as adults, where you don't mess with these things. We're just going to assume that you're here because you want to be taken seriously and you're taking these ideas seriously.
Mm-hmm. And if you're studying ideas, if you take even a couple courses at the university level, where do you go? Are you talking about study of philosophy?
You can take courses in the history of philosophy, certainly, in the classics departments. In my own department, the Department of History, I teach a course on modern American intellectual history. I have a colleague who teaches a course in European intellectual history. So these courses certainly exist. And some political theory courses start really with kind of the very beginning, the roots of the canon. But students have to really search them out. And sometimes that can be hard to do and hard to balance against the demands of your major and the sense that, what are you going to do with a philosophy degree? The way in which students feel that they really have to justify these things in terms of a cash value, it's a very dangerous pressure, I think, that they feel.
Right. So the cash pressure is pretty enormous now. Students feel as though they need to go into studies of business, say, because they feel they can make a living once they're out of school.
That's right. Or the STEM fields, right?
Right.
The science and technology and math fields. And a lot of that pressure is also coming from the university itself. As I watch, the powers that be in my own university really put a lot of support and funding into STEM courses. Politicians, too, right, say we need far more engineers than we do philosophy majors and this sort of thing, coming from both the left and the right. Again, this is not a partisan problem. From all angles, students are being just bowled over with the message, to study ideas, to study the history of where your own worldview came from. This won't get you a job, and therefore it's a waste of time. And I think that's wrong. On both counts. I think there are a lot of practical skills to be gained in serious critical engagement with history and philosophy. But even aside from that, it matters so deeply, especially in our current political situation, in which so many assumptions about what's left and what's right and what's good for the country, these have been totally shredded by the results of the last election. And I think people on both the left and the right have to drill down and come to grips with these foundational assumptions behind their political platforms and learn where those came from and learn to make the case for them again.
Mm-hmm. When you look at the various seminars and what it is that the students are reading, is there a common list that everybody's reading a certain thinker? Are there certain required thinkers? And then after the required thinkers, is there great variation in the number of other conservative philosophers the students would be reading?
I'd say there's a fair amount of variation between the programs. There are probably some thinkers that appear again and again. So most of the programs feature some engagement with one or two of the founding fathers, for example. Adam Smith is a popular name. But, for example, the Claremont Institute really emphasizes the founding fathers and the American tradition. And so their reading lists are very, very American and don't tend to go so far back. They really begin with the 18th century, whereas the Hertog Fellows will start with classical philosophy. And the John Jay Fellows spend more time with Christian thinkers, Thomas Aquinas, Augustine, people like this. And I would be the first to say that I find these reading lists far too narrow. I think that, the idea of the canon is a valuable one as long as we don't limit it to this quite pinched view of a certain number of white men in positions of power, essentially. I think there's even more to be gained if we bring other voices into conversation with these classic, dead white men, so to speak. But that doesn't mean, that typical liberal critique of the canon is useful if it's a tool for expanding the canon rather than demolishing the very idea of it.
What would be even more interesting would be to get the same group of students, because I'm sure they're highly motivated and they like to read and they're willing to learn. What a great group to have in front of you. I'm sure you'd like that every single day in the work that you do. And to have them read both a conservative canon and a liberal canon, and have people who might be inclined to one persuasion or the other, and then debate their ideas. Wouldn't that be more interesting?
Oh, absolutely. That's certainly the ideal, and from the point of view of education, and it's what I try to do in my own classroom. It's how I structure my course on American intellectual history. I love the weeks where I get to pair left-wing thinkers with right-wing thinkers and really expose what exactly are the underlying issues driving these debates here. And students love it. Students really thrive on that. But I want to be clear. I think that there are several ways to usefully approach the study of ideas in our culture. One certainly is education, where I have no partisan aim in my course. And I'm always gratified that students usually leave my course confused and uncertain about what my own views are, because I simply don't seek to inculcate my own views in the students. But I do think in the political sphere, the study of ideas does have a role as well on both the left and the right in a serious and useful kind of training and education for people who really want to be political activists. I think you can do both without doing a disservice to this tradition we're talking about.
Let's welcome some phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Professor Molly Worthen is the author of Apostles of Reason, The Crisis of Authority in American Evangelicalism. She's an assistant professor of history at the University of North Carolina, a contributing writer to the New York Times, and wrote a piece that caught our attention, Can I Go to Great Books Camp? Our number is 800-486-8655. We'd love to hear from you. And she writes, in case you're just tuning us in, about a small number of mostly conservative study groups, and they're very serious study groups, and there's a stipend for young people who want to come to these groups, or maybe a weekend, and some of them are months long, where they take very seriously the big thinkers of the conservative movement. Some of them are looking at American thinkers, and some are going with world thinkers. There have been some liberal groups as well, but not quite as many of those. We have yet to really explore why that's the case. But it sounds like fun, doesn't it, to get together with other young people for a couple weeks and really delve into great thinkers of our time and why they believe what they believe, to get some knowledge. This knowledge is good. We'll be with you in just one. Oh, tons of phone calls coming in. Good. All right, we'll be with you in a moment here on the Ideas Network. All right, let's start taking phone calls. Katie in San Francisco. Hi, Katie.
Hi, how are you? Good morning.
Hi.
From my end of the world, good morning.
Good morning.
Just wanted to make one quick comment. I have a son, a 23-year-old son, who is going to St. John's College in Annapolis. It is a classics-based college. It's the oldest college in the United States, kind of a hidden gem. And he's there totally studying all the classics mentioned, from Aristotle all the way through the Christian thinkers and the American thinkers as well. And I sent him there because the world needs thinkers going forward. And that's why he's there.
Mm. And what does he think about it? Does he like it?
Yeah, I think he does. It took a while for him to get used to it. It is in the Socratic format, so it's not lecture and not, I mean, they read and they go in and they sit and they discuss. Hmm. And then they actually get assessed on their discussion and participation and leadership. So it's a whole different format than anything he'd been used to. It took him about a year to get used to it, and now I think he's on a roll. And his leadership skills are coming out, and his ability to formulate ideas and present them and persuade are so much more effective. A conversation with my son on the phone now is crazy, because it's all about philosophy. He's challenging everything I say with, well, what if? But it's so exciting to see this happen. And I'm out here in San Francisco, where the whole world is tech, and my whole career has been tech, and I just felt that too much of a good thing. We need to get some basics back and get some thinkers who can help us out through these troubled times.
Katie, does he have any idea what he wants to explore when he's out of school?
You know, his his passion was biology. So he really thought he was going to go down, you know, UW and be a biologist. And I don't really know where it's going to take him, which is kind of exciting. He may do that. He may go back into science. But I think, you know, he will certainly have the thought skills to figure it out.
Yes, I'm sure you will.
Yeah, I know, and I think, you know, part of parenting, even for a 20-year-old, is, and especially if you've got some life experiences in other areas and in other industries, is to say, hey, this is what you can do with that. For example, you mentioned I know out here that a lot of people with a philosophy background get into the tech industry. In Google, I think there were, in Cisco way back when, there were a lot of philosophy leaders, and so there's an appreciation of that ability to think in some tech industries. So I think the world's his.
Thank you very much, Katie. I wasn't familiar with that school. Are you, Molly?
Oh, yeah. That's so heartening. I'm just really encouraged by everything Katie had to say. I've known about St. John's for a long time and always admired it. And in fact, one of the Hertog program alumni who I interviewed for this article is herself a graduate from St. John's and loved it and wanted more of the same. And in fact, she herself was also a math and science person. But what that meant at St. John's was getting into it through the history of math and science, the ancient history of math and science, and deeply, you know, studying Euclid and Ptolemy and really understanding the absolute foundations of Western science. And that, for her, turned into a vocation that led her more toward politics and journalism. But I don't think she's ever lost connection with her interests in the physical world. And for her, it's all one consistent worldview. And I'm so heartened to hear that Silicon Valley has an appreciation for the kind of very rigorous critical thinking that an education like the one at St. John's can provide.
Hmm. And Katie, if you don't mind, what about your own education? Where did you go? And what did
it was eclectic. I studied art in New Mexico, and then I went back to school and studied laser electro-optics. And that got
oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I know. and I'm constantly retraining. So I spent years in technology out here in California. And then I got my degree, and then I went back in my 50s for a master's degree in psychology with creativity studies and technology as the basis of the exploration. And who knows what's next? I'd like to go to St. John's, frankly.
Well, I don't see any reason why you shouldn't, Katie. But I think your son needs to graduate first, right?
Yeah, I guess that's right, yeah.
Thank you very much for calling. It might be the basis of a strong education because so many people change their field so often, Molly, don't they?
That's right, especially now. I mean, the statistics seem to go up every year, the number of times the average person totally changes fields. And so whatever skills you may devote yourself to gaining during your university years, you may find that either they're quickly obsolete or they don't apply to the field you're in 10 or 15 years from now, whereas simply learning critical thinking, learning how to put together an argument and express that argument in oral speech and on the page, these are timeless skills. I think you'd be hard-pressed to identify a field in which they are not highly valued. And my own colleagues in other professions, the law, the business world, all complain constantly that they cannot get new recruits who know how to write and think and talk. So these skills are really valuable. The other things, you know, you can learn. You will have to constantly learn your whole career. I think this is the theme of the 21st century economy.
Mm-hmm. And yet you look at all that's pushing against that, and let's talk a little bit about that. Do you have to admonish your students to turn off their telephones and to really put their minds to the task at hand?
I do, and they're always grateful in the end. I have a lot of colleagues who ban laptops and phones entirely from their lecture courses. I choose not to ban them. Rather, on the first day of class, I present students with data from studies that indicate that taking notes by hand results in far better retention of the information and far better learning.
Oh.
And that usually encourages most of them to put aside their computers and take notes by hand. And they're usually very glad for it and say that it really did improve their experience of the class. My colleagues who ban technology say that they always get a little pushback in the beginning, but students at the end of the semester thank them. I think students appreciate simply having an oasis, having a break from the constant dinging of their phone, a chance to simply focus their attention on one thing. I mean, so much of this is about grasping this very rare opportunity to teach them a longer attention span, an ability to really focus and think about one thing for a concerted period of time, which is what you have to do if you want to get anywhere.
Right. Thank you so much, Katie. I'm glad you were listening. Anne from Green Bay writes, it's worth mentioning that words like conservative and liberal have changed radically over the past century and have not always been linked to the parties, and certainly not the ideologies that they are now.
That is absolutely right. These labels are very anachronistic when we seek to apply them to thinkers even you know a century ago, let alone in ancient Greece and Rome. So I think in many cases this idea of a conservative canon of books that only conservatives have any business reading is rather silly, and that there are many thinkers that we tend to label conservative that I think are done a great disservice by such a label. Someone like Adam Smith is known for his vision of what we now call classical libertarian free market economics without regulation as we know it today. And that grew out of a particular 18th century context. But what we often forget about Adam Smith is that he had a deeply developed theory of moral sympathy and sentiments and a notion of the human empathy that is the groundwork for morality, really separate and apart from ideas that are particular to the Judeo-Christian tradition. And that part of Adam Smith is not at all particularly conservative. So that's just one example of a thinker who is so much broader than these partisan labels make them, and who I wish people on both sides of the spectrum would engage with more fully.
Chet is next in Oregon. Hi, Chet.
Hello. Yes, I found it kind of interesting that like places like the state of Wisconsin, the legislators are trying to legislate that an equal amount of conservative philosophy is taught in the schools and lectures and so on and so forth, when that's really not really free thinking at all. And if you just look at the word conservative, that's what it is. There's no open thought. There's no open new ideas. I mean, honestly, if it were up to conservatives, we'd all be living in caves. And I want to add to that that many of the people that started small businesses, corporations, and so on, the first generation of people that actually got them going, were actually, in fact, progressives. And that's just my feelings on that whole subject.
Thank you, Chet, for calling. Molly?
Yeah, well, I think that the kind of conversation about the conservative tradition and what conservatives' public missions should be that I found myself having with people associated with these programs was not necessarily the one that you might hear if you stopped your average Republican state legislator or someone in the current administration. And in fact, many of these conservatives, people associated with places like Hertog or the John Jay Institute, they found themselves to be a bit they felt a bit like outsiders to their own party, and many of them expressed to me a deep ambivalence about particularly what they acknowledged as the very real anti-intellectual strain in their own in their own party at this time. Now, I think there is anti-intellectualism on the left as well, but certainly it was a feature of Republican politics in particular in this past election, and it's one that really really troubled a number of the people I spoke to.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that it may be said of much of America right now, don't you think, or not?
Yes. The term, anti-intellectual, I suppose, can mean any number of things. And I don't think it's hard to understand why a lot of Americans who have found themselves on the losing end of the global free market are kind of impatient with talk of ideas and ideology. They want to know what it will mean for their pocketbooks, and I understand that. And so, there's this human impulse, perhaps, toward impatience. And that's perhaps been stronger in the past few years because of the fallout after the economic crisis of 2007-2008. And in American politics in general, over the past several centuries, there's been certainly a kind of populist impulse that's risen and fallen, you know, now and again over history, that has sometimes taken the form of a deep hostility toward the quote-unquote elites, people
yes.
associated with universities. Now, in other cases, it's been actually very intellectual. I mean, if you go back and read the early populists, the populists of the 1890s who sought more regulation, who sought to make the free market fair for the little guy, these men and women were real intellectuals. They were usually self-taught. They went and heard lecturers, academics who were brought in by their political leaders to teach them about how the economy works, you know, the banking system, and they mastered, they might barely be able to write, but they mastered these very sophisticated ideas and absolutely saw the connection between the world of ideas and their grassroots political movement. And it would be wonderful if we could recover some of their sentiment today.
Mm. Let's talk about the presidents for a moment. I'm not sure what the situation is with President Donald Trump, but a lot of people have written that he doesn't read very many books. He watches a great deal of television when he's in the White House during the evening. He does read the New York Post, New York Times, and Washington Post, but I'm not sure how many books he's reading. The president before him, there was a big story I'm sure you saw in the Times where yes. he was interviewed about the books that he's reading and how books have made an extraordinary influence on his understanding of other human beings, of empathy, etc. Does it make a difference for us to have the most powerful leader in this country to be reading and to be reading intellectual thinkers and also to be reading great novelists? And do we aspire to do the same if we see them do that?
It makes an enormous difference. It is very frightening. The more I learn about President Trump's modes of consuming information, the more I tremble. I mean, especially in our current environment in which to consume most of your news from television usually means watching, you know, the partisan channel that confirms your pre-existing prejudices. And I love what you said about the role of the novel in enhancing our own empathy for other human beings. I think that's entirely the point of not just reading literature, but also studying history. I tell my students, you know, our aim before we pass any kind of critical judgment on whoever we're reading about, I don't care if it's Hitler, I don't care if it's Stalin, is to get into the person's shoes and really try to process the world from their perspective, no matter how different it is from your own, no matter how heinous. Down the road, you can pass all the moral judgment you want, but first, your job is empathy. And I think it's not just a matter of training these students to be better historians, but also training them to be better citizens, to have empathy for people who don't look or think or live where they do, especially when it comes to making decisions about how we as a society care for one another.
Our number is 800-486-8655. Jake in Oshkosh is next. Hi, Jake.
Good afternoon, Kathleen.
Hi, Jake.
I would like to read something that John Dean, the former Nixon White House counsel, wrote in 2006 in his book, Conservatives Without a Conscience. It's titled Triumph of the Authoritarians. It's two sentences, and then I'd like to get the guest comment. Today's Republican policies are antithetical to bedrock conservative fundamentals. There is nothing conservative about preemptive wars or disregarding international law by condoning torture, abandoning fiscal responsibility is now standard operating procedure. Bible thumping, finger pointing, tongue lashing attacks on homosexuals are not found in Russell Kirk's classic conservative canons or in James Burhan's Guide to Conservative Governing.
Professor Worthen.
Well, I personally have a great deal of sympathy with Dean's assessment, to be sure. And I think that many observers would say that what makes all of those features that Dean describes in that passage, quote, conservative, is that they seek to conserve cultural and political and economic power for a certain small group of Americans, and that's become the unifying feature in the face of the growing diversity and pluralism of this country, that there is developed on the right a kind of reactionary desire to hold on to cultural and economic power, and it can be very ugly. I think that's for sure. I think too that what limits both politicians on the right and the left who seek to solve some of the pressing social problems we face in this country is that the United States is a revolutionary state that in the act of breaking from Great Britain truncated our spectrum of acceptable political approaches to problems. And what I mean by that is that the founding fathers sort of cut off a whole wing of Anglo tradition that we would describe as Tory, a kind of a vision of big government involvement in the lives of citizens, centralized planning, that later evolved into both left and right forms. On the left, we would call it, social democracy. And you see in every other Western country forms of right-wing and left-wing politics that have a more robust vision of government and social planning. But in the United States, we don't really have that. If you start talking about a lot of central planning, then suddenly you're labeled a socialist. And even on the left, it's very hard to talk in those terms. So I think that very pinched aspect of our political culture is one feature of the mess we're in today.
A listener writes, these ancient texts were also used to justify liberal thought, not just conservative. And please have your guest talk about the classical text studies in original languages that have gone on at UW-Madison since day one.
Well, that's absolutely true. You know, I mean, the ancient Greeks and Romans, on the one hand, had all kinds of nasty ideas about women and slavery and the superiority of elites that we would not today condone, I think, either on the right or the left. But on the other hand, their tradition of talking about the human person and the dignity of the human person and the interaction between the Greco-Roman tradition and early Christian and Jewish thought certainly is the wellspring of our modern tradition of human rights. And I think absolutely people on the left have equal claim to that as those on the right. And certainly the ongoing study of those texts in their original languages and in their original cultural contexts continues to inform our understanding of how we can learn from those ancient cultures.
And I'm wondering if that's still a popular field. Are there many people who are doing just that, Professor?
No, I would say there are very few. The classics departments, to the extent that they still exist at most universities, are small and are often shrinking or at best holding steady. I have a colleague who does teach a very popular course on ancient athletics, where he has the students go out onto the field and reenact, you know, ancient Greek javelin throwing and things like this. And it's a great way of getting the students excited and giving them kind of a way into that ancient culture that then can sometimes lead on to further engagement with the ideas. But in general, true study of the classics involves a very demanding linguistic burden of mastering or at least beginning to learn these difficult ancient languages. And even short of that, the ideas are hard. And again, we come back to that problem we talked about at the top of the hour of whether making the case for the, quote, pragmatic value of courses in ancient philosophy. And many students are put off, I think, because they're not sure that, you know, it justifies the tuition dollar.
Gail is next in Fish Creek. Hi, Gail.
Well, hi. I have a concern of how much of the history that is actually being shared, being that there's an attempt being made, and it was started in Texas, to alter history and remove things or tweak things to a different tone. But there's so much in history that is missing that people in the curriculum in the U.S. just really hasn't touched on. And some of it then can be detrimental to the overall ego sense of the power worth of the government of the country and how that relates on to the people and the history of the people around the world has a lot to do, I think, with a social whole that all people come from, taken away from even a liberal view and looking at still a separatist idea coming in and taking over conservative views. And that's a big concern that I have of where these young minds and young influential people are going to be in 20, 30 years. They're going to be the middle-aged people who are going to be looking at taking business and taking government. And if they have this separatist kind of underlying impression put upon them that comes from all of these subliminal forms, I'm very concerned that what is being shared in history isn't now and hasn't been, will it be in the future, a more accurate history?
Professor Worthen?
That's very interesting. The caller is referring to the ongoing debates in Texas over the reform and revision of history textbooks used in public schools. And for a long time, these debates in Texas have had ramifications for the country as a whole because Texas is such a big textbook market that publishers would historically gear their books toward whatever the Texans wanted, and then many of the rest of the states would end up having to buy those books as well. I'll say that that's a bit less true now because publishers are simply able to tailor books to local constituencies a little bit better, but it's still important. And what's happened is that a conservative constituency on the Board of Education in Texas has lobbied to strip out from history textbooks, particularly I think in the U.S. History Advanced Placement course for high school students, references to Che Guevara and Cesar Chavez and some the progressives and radicals associated with the 60s and 70s to reduce the treatment of people of color, to change the language used to describe the New Deal into what I think progressives would see as a kind of a more negative characterization, and to emphasize America's noble aims and successes in venues like the Vietnam War, for example, very controversial aspects of our history, the aim being to fill students with a sense of patriotism and pride in their country. This is the conservative argument that you hear, that too much criticism, too much in the textbooks about how bad slavery was and the arguments of various radical activists, it leaves students feeling down on their country, and it also leaves them with a poor appreciation for free market capitalism, the real genius of American democracy. This is the conservative argument. And I share the caller's concern these conservative corrections are really not correcting a course that's gone off in the wrong direction, but rather they are scrubbing out the very modest amount of pluralism that is in these textbooks now that for so long was wholly absent. Your caller's later comments about this kind of conservative sense of separatism, I think, are very interesting because there is among American conservatives a long tradition of thinking of themselves as this oppressed remnant, this kind of holy,
yes,
you know, this small embattled sect, and God is on their side, but you know, hardly anybody else is, and they have to battle to save the country from these foreign elements. On the other hand, of course, there's also this kind of contesting narrative of conservatives as the true marrow of the country and true Americans, and the two paradoxical strains in conservative thinking have been twisted for a very long time. And I agree that it can be a dangerous mentality. Certainly you encounter this mentality on the left as well. I think human beings, we like to think of ourselves as part of a small group who really gets it, who really understands how things ought to be and no one else does. It's an appealing mindset, but it's certainly not a recipe for political compromise or peaceful coexistence.
Professor Molly Worthen is our guest this hour. She wrote a piece that we're talking about this hour, although we've expanded to other areas during the hour. Can I go to Great Books Camp? And she writes about these Great Books camps. There are not a huge number, but a significant number of them. And young people in their 20s, college students, spend maybe a weekend, sometimes a few months, studying conservative thinkers in settings that require their full attention. And it's something that hasn't happened as much with liberal thinkers. We'll talk about why as we continue and take more of your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is the number. Next caller is Annie in Watertown. Hi, Annie.
Hi. There's been so much that doesn't make sense about some of this. But one thing she said toward the beginning was that these kids were going to school to become not journalists, study journalism. They were going to become conservative journalists, which just goes against everything I'm trying to figure out here, why there has to be two different kinds of this.
Well, it is a great question. I'll say to begin with that in many ways, the way in which we evaluate and complain about the current state of the media is based on the way the American media has conducted itself for a relatively brief period of time, from, I suppose, the 1930s, 1940s, up through the 70s and 80s. There was this brief glory era of what I'll call objective, grand man, bird's eye view, above the fray journalism, in which, you know, people like Walter Cronkite really sought to carve out the identity of the journalist as a statesman who is not bogged down in partisan politics, who tries to simply tell it as it is and give the American people accurate, unbiased information. The fact is that that's not how the newspaper and media world was prior to that time. For centuries, you know, you go back to the Revolution through the 19th century, you know, you find cheap newspapers funded by political parties and very politically minded editors who had a political vision in mind in the articles they ran and the editorials they wrote. And in some ways, it's not that we are today entering some new, untested, unfamiliar era, but rather we're simply returning to the way the newspaper industry was for most of its history. Now, I say that, but I share the caller's lament about this, that there has come to be two kinds of journalism, that the New York Times is not the paper of record for everybody, but that it is perceived as having this liberal bias. And I think those young people who are going into, quote, conservative journalism see them as providing this correction, or what, you know, Kellyanne Conway called on Meet the Press the other day, alternative facts. And it's incredibly dangerous. Now, there are responsible ways, of course, to do conservative or liberal journalism, and these take the form of some of the established magazines of the 20th century. You know, on the left, a magazine like The Nation or The New Republic. On the right, a magazine like National Review or The Weekly Standard. These are self-consciously magazines of political opinion. They don't try to pass themselves off as newspapers, providing a kind of first draft of history. They are declaring themselves to be in the act of interpreting current events from a particular ideological standpoint. That's not the same thing as what an entity like Fox News or Breitbart is doing, to my mind, in which they're not supplementing your morning newspaper read, but rather they are taking its place. And they are providing you with these alternative facts. And it's very dangerous.
One more phone call. We have less than a minute, though. Cindy in Fox Cities. Hi.
I'll make it quick. The textbooks may take out the history, but at least the movie producers are keeping that fresh for us, like things like 13 Years a Slave and the Hidden Figures movie, which is about the black women who helped the space program, and, of course, Hamilton, which is hot on stage right now. So at least we still have some of those options to maybe not have all the facts, but at least to keep that kind of history fresh in our mind.
Is the movie industry helping us learn history?
I think on balance, yes. I mean, historians always have their quibbles with these movies because there's probably never been a movie made by Hollywood that was 100% accurate in every fact. But listen, if it gets students interested, if it prompts them to go and read some books, then I am all for it.
Right. And certainly Hamilton has done that, and Hidden Figures has done that as well. There's been a lot of attention paid to the space program. Well, this was an interesting hour, Molly. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Professor Molly Worthen. Molly's piece appeared in the New York Times December 3rd, actually, and it's on our Facebook page. We thought it would make for an interesting show. Can I Go to Great Books Camp? These are popping up all over the country. Some of them are 7-week crash courses. Some of them are just a weekend in political history, and they're offered by conservative organizations. They read different books depending on who's sponsoring them. There are a couple liberal ones, but not nearly as many. But she teaches history, and I guess the question can be asked, why don't we know more about our past? And why don't we have courses where both are taught and students are studying quite seriously our political traditions? So thanks very much to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, to Colleen Duvall for on-air work here in our studios in Milwaukee, and thanks for your calls. We'll be with you again on Monday for our beginning of the week conversation, which just happens to be All Things Political.